What's up? Welcome to the Plus Pitch Podcast. It is August 2nd. My name is Jake Crumpler, and I'll be your host for this edition of the podcast. Let's dive into every single start from August 1st. Welcome to my birth month. We'll start it off with a prospect. In the dog days of summer, clubs tend to promote top prospect talent. The reasons can sort of range from getting a taste of the majors before their first full season to a reason to get fans excited about the future or a lightning bolt to help the team make a surge in the standings, with the Cardinals finding themselves with 5.9% odds to make the playoffs according to FanGraphs. They decided to give one of their promising young starters his first big league action to get him acclimated to the sport's highest level. Quinn Matthews, the club's number 7 prospect, according to MLB Pipeline, made his MLB debut in Toronto on Saturday with 5 innings, 2 earned, 6 hits, 3 walks, 3 strikeouts, 12 whiffs, 29% CSW across 97 pitches. And I think he's a lot more exciting than the line suggests. The 25-year-old 6'5" southpaw features a dope four-seamer as his primary pitch. It sat 94 to 95 miles per hour with plenty of rise, 17 inches of IVB at a flat attack angle, 1.6 HAVA on the pitch with above average extension at 6.6 feet. And those are awesome characteristics, especially with a decently low arm angle that might be as low as below 30 inches, which if that is the case, and this is not just a fluke of data, then that 17 inches of IVB is legit, and that fastball is incredible. And he also displayed the intent to throw the pitch upstairs, which is exactly what you want to see with a heater of that shape. It led to 5 whiffs, 38% CSW, and 65% strikes on the four-seamer for Quinn Matthews, setting a stable base off of which his secondaries could build. Matthews supports the fastball with a slew of secondaries, a slider, changeup, and curveball. The 86-mile-per-hour slider grades out as his best pitch, and with his ability to keep it on the edges of the zone while avoiding the heart of the plate, it returned 74% strikes while living in the zone 61% of the time and inducing a trio of whiffs. The slider should be a supportive strike pitch against right-handed batters and an effective put-away slash whiff offering versus left-handed batters. The other breaker is a slow 76 to 77-mile-per-hour curveball with tons of vertical break, and I'd love for this to be like your get me over surprise called strike pitch, but I think he may have a tough time commanding it with how much break it has. It does grade out well, and he did a great job of keeping it low, so it could actually be a supportive tertiary offering when he's missing his slider command, acting as that whiff pitch against right-handed batters when he doesn't have the slider to support the fastball, and his changeup, which I think is going to be the real difference maker. If Matthews can command the slow ball low and arm side consistently like he did here, he has the makings of a swatch, a southpaw with a tight changeup, and he has plenty more upside thanks to the pretty impressive fastball slider combo we saw here at 83 to 84 miles per hour. There's a massive velocity differential between the changeup and Matthews heater, and it can live out of the zone to hunt chases for whiffs if the rest of his arsenal can keep the strikes flowing. It all has the makings of a pitcher who should dominate at the big league level as long as he commands his pitches well, and that's sort of where the concerns for Matthews arises. He has consistently struggled with free passes in the minor leagues at AAA across the past 3 seasons. He's recorded a 17.7% walk rate, 17.5% walk rate, and a 14% walk rate. That's across the past 3 seasons at AAA. And prospect reports suggest that Matthews has battled his mechanics in the past and that he worked extensively on adding strength to combat the inconsistency of his pitching motion. He seemed to have quelled the concerns about his control issues with a single-digit walk rate across his final 9 starts in the minors this year, and I'm hoping that is an indicator of what to expect moving forward. If Matthews can avoid resurfacing the issues that led to inconsistent mechanics throughout his minor league career and continues to throw plenty of strikes with an effective Blake Snell blueprint approach driven by a dope fastball and trio of effective secondaries, he's going to thrive in the big leagues. With Rocky Road up next, I'm all for giving this a shot and seeing how he performs and then going from there. There's plenty in Matthew's favor to become a legitimate swatch with breakout potential for 2027. Now let's see how every other starting pitcher did on Saturday. Martin Perez against the Nationals, 7 shutout innings, 1 hit, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts. The Vargas rule that appeared to come to an end entering the All-Star break was supported by the assertion that he just fell apart after the All-Star break as well. A pair of post-All-Star break outings suggested he didn't get back on track, but he got back on track here, dominating the lefty killing Nationals with impeccable sinker and changeup command downstairs. And I say that he appeared to get back on track because the indicators that we look to determine sustainability all suggest that Perez just had luck and Koufax on his side. We can't expect him to repeat this success in the Bronx next after he stole 12 called strikes with sinkers, earned just 54% strikes on changeups, and returned 16 outs on 17 balls in play. So Martin Perez, too lucky here to suggest that he can do it again next time. Next, we got Drew Rasmussen against the White Sox, 6 shutout innings, 4 hits, 1 walk, 10 strikeouts. He induced 18 whiffs with 36% CSW to earn the golden goal, as Rasmussen had a season high 19.6 inches of vert on his fastball, which allowed it to absolutely dominate upstairs to the tune of 10 whiffs, 76% strikes, and 7 punchouts. And you love to see it from Drew Rasmussen. Next, we got Christopher Sanchez in Baltimore, 6 scoreless innings, 2 hits, 5 walks, 11 strikeouts. And Sanchez made a case to regain his AGA tag with impressive yet unsustainable success. He issued a season high 5 walks despite the 11 strikeouts here, as off-speed pitches combined for just 45% strikes. That's changeups and sliders, just 45% strikes. He also returned 7 outs on 9 balls in play, fortunate batted ball luck, and he racked up those 11 strikeouts via an 85% put-away rate, which is unsustainable, suggesting he didn't deserve as many strikeouts, or at least he won't have this many strikeouts moving forward. And we'll see how good Sanchez is at creating fortunate luck against the lefty killing Nationals next, though I do question how good the Nationals will be against southpaws moving forward without Curtis Meade in that lineup. But Sanchez, I don't think, did enough here to earn that ace is going to ace tag back despite the 11 strikeouts. Next, we have Brent Suter, who opened for Brett Carey with 2 scoreless innings. Brett Carey followed with 4 innings, 1 earned, no walks, 3 strikeouts. He induced 9 whiffs with 31% CSW in his second big league appearance. And with Ryan Johnson optioned to the minors and the Angels looking to deal from the rotation at the deadline, I don't know if you guys saw that social media post from the Angels about how they took Jose Soriano out of the rotation to hopefully trade him at the deadline. I've never seen anything like it, but regardless, all of that going on means Brett Carey should stick on the pitching staff for the foreseeable future. And whether the Angels are willing to stretch Carey out to a starter's workload will determine his fantasy valuability. However, with an ERA north of 7.5 in each of his last 2 seasons in the minors, it's likely that he's only going to be viable in the deepest of AL-only leagues. That slider is not good enough to prepare to propel Carey to success. Next, we have David Peterson against the Yankees, 6 1/3 innings, 1 earned, 5 hits, no walks, 8 strikeouts. And now you've got our attention, David Peterson. It wasn't the excellent pitch separation that got us excited in his last start, but he did tie his season high with 8 strikeouts against the mighty Bronx Bombers, which is enough to get me excited. He generally kept sinkers low and arm side with 4 seamers sitting upstairs, while sliders dominated left-handed batters for 4 whiffs and 3 strikeouts, and changeups came alive for 39% CSW with increased usage to make him a potential swatch. With command improvements, a better defense behind him, and now a new strikeout ceiling to chase, Peterson may be worth your attention versus the struggling Blue Jays lineup up next. Shane Boz pitched against the Phillies, 6 1/3 innings, 1 earned, 6 hits, 1 walk, 4 strikeouts. He altered his approach to right-handed batters, leaning on sinkers in the zone 23% more often, leading to 80% weak contact and 80% ground balls off of the sinker. It sort of took the pressure off cutters and four seamers to nibble the edges like he usually does against right-handed batters, but I'm not sure that's enough to change Boz's outlook. It was the same four seamer curveball and changeup approach versus left-handed batters, and his hook was deployed like a lazy fisherman as it was just all over the zone. And it's extra tick of velocity here, removed 2 inches of depth. So he threw the curveball harder, but it had less movement. I'd say still send him out there in Texas next, but don't expect Boz to keep up the 2.62 ERA he's recorded across his last six starts, the 1.34 whip and 21% strikeout rate during that time are easy and clear indicators to suggest that he's been lucky at stranding base runners and that he's been too reliant on batted balls finding gloves. Next, we have Kevin Gausman versus the Cardinals, 5 2/3 innings, 1 earned, 9 hits, 1 walk, 4 strikeouts. And at this point, we're just happy when Gausman throws strikes and avoids the long ball. He actually has not served up a dinger in each of his last 5 starts, but that doesn't mean he's not prone to being singled out. Gausman survived 5 shutout frames with 7 singles against him before a pair of doubles in the 6th knocked in his first run and sent him to the bench. That's a careful Icarus in my book, as Gausman maybe should have been pulled after 5 solid innings. His splitter cooked though with 8 whiffs, while 4 seamers thrived in the zone for 83% strikes. And we're going to run it back, y'all. Next, we have Max Fried on the north side of Chicago, 5 1/3 innings, 1 earned, 2 hits, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. And with Fried closing in on 80 pitches, he had 78 pitches in this one and this electric start in the Windy City. I think that means we're just 1 successful start away from Fried's coronation day. He faces his former ball club against the Braves next. Noah Schultz pitched in Tampa Bay, 5 innings, 1 earned, 3 hits, no walks, 4 strikeouts. And the fix for everything, I guess, is always to just have an opener go before a pitcher. Jordan Hicks started this one, allowing Schultz to get a running start in the second frame. And he leaned heavily on center cut sinkers, stealing 8 called strikes and returning 100% outs on 6 balls in play. I like Schultz's ability to jam right-handed batters with cutters, but sweepers and changeups have yet to emerge as the whiff offerings they need to be to allow Schultz to achieve his potential. And honestly, I'm just playing that looping Charlie Brown missing the football gif in my head anytime Schultz pitches this year. Next, we have Braxton Ashcraft in Cincinnati, 5 innings, 1 earned, 2 hits, 1 walk, 5 strikeouts. And honestly, we're not out of the woods yet. Ashcraft is still only able to command one of his secondaries at a time as curveballs return just 41% strikes here. The issues against left-handed batters persist as well, as he threw 73% of his pitches against lefties in the zone, and he somehow lived to tell the tale thanks to 7 outs on 8 balls in play via 75% grounders and 63% weak contact. So Ashcraft survived in the zone with his ability to induce a bunch of grounders and weak contact. I don't think that's sustainable. That's not an approach we've seen from him this year. The only damage against Ashcraft came on a Jose Trevino home run that was sort of like a flick of the wrist on a well-located four-seamer upstairs. And Trevino did take Jacob Mizorowski deep earlier this year, and his 2 other homers came on a day in Coors. So he's had a very interesting season this year. But Ashcraft otherwise avoided the heart of the plate versus right-handed batters with honestly pretty impressive command around the edges of the zone. He had no pitches that landed middle. And I can't really say that Ashcraft is all the way back until he's pulling off an effective approach against left-handed batters with command of both of his breakers. Next, we have Robert Gasser in LA against the Angels, 5 innings, 1 earned, 4 hits, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts. And I wish Gasser threw gas and not 92 to 93 miles per hour so I could make some easy jokes about his fastball. I also wish he commanded better and showcased a heavier reliance on changeups because he faces so many right-handed batters. And that's a great pitch to keep right-handed batters at bay. And we'll take these results here against the Angels, but we can't expect him to get away with his center cut locations, a clear lack of approach, and underwhelming stuff for much longer. I'd say we blame it on the Angels for Gasser's success here. And honestly, he might be removed from the rotation as soon as tomorrow if the Brewers can land an arm at the deadline. I feel like Gasser would be out of the rotation before Shane Drohan. Next, Parker Messick versus the Diamondbacks, 4 1/3 innings, 1 earned, 6 hits, 1 walk, 6 strikeouts. It's not the around 95 mile per hour velocity he's displayed recently in 5 of his last 8 starts, but we'll take 94 to 95 miles per hour when Messick's able to pull off the Blake Snell blueprint with 4 seamers upstairs and changeups low. And you're probably wondering, if Messick commanded so well, why didn't he survive 5 frames? You can blame his inefficiency on deep counts. He had 70% two strike counts in this one. And you can blame the early hook on a rough 5th that opened with a strikeout but ended with three straight singles and an error that knocked Messick out of the ball game. We'll take the ERA here with just one run across four and a third innings, and we'll take the strikeouts, six of those here. But a win really would have been nice from Parker Messick. Next, we have Framber Valdez in Sacramento. Seven innings, two earned, nine hits, two walks, and six strikeouts. And with the Tigers angering the baseball world by dealing Tarek Skubal to the Dodgers, don't get me started on that one. Valdez gave Tigers fans hope that they've still got an elite southpaw in town. Valdez finally read the SP roundup, I guess, and he realized that everything rides on his curveball. So he said, "I live and die by the hook." He threw it a season high 42% of the time to ensure that he was going to get the job done. It's like, if he throws enough curveballs, it's going to work. The rest of his arsenal arrived to prop up the strike rate and join in the ground ball churning party, which is Valdez's signature. As a ground ball pitcher, he's prone to BABIP fluctuations, but this dusty donut was pretty ridiculous. He got you good ratios on the ERA, but the whip was terrible. We'll take the ERA and the six strikeouts, but that whip was super unlucky as he allowed eight singles on 73% ground balls, and not even Javier Baez playing shortstop could gobble up all of those grounders off the bat against Framber Valdez. Next, we have Peyton Tolley in LA against the Dodgers. Six innings, two earned, nine hits, two walks, and seven strikeouts. And Tolley had the baseball world rooting for him as he took on the trade deadline tyrants, and he manhandled them with four seamers and cutters. It's really a slider. Those two pitches combined for 13 whiffs and 75% strikes, allowing Tolley to withstand a ridiculous 500 BABIP that produced those nine hits in this one. And after surviving Sacre Verde and Hollywood, Tolley gets some respite with the A's in Boston, and then he heads to Toronto before hosting the Diamondbacks. And that's a trio of starts that has me feeling very confident starting Peyton Tolley moving forward. Next, we'll talk about Tyler Phillips, Cole Drake, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, and Logan Gilbert, and the rest of the pitchers from Saturday starts. But first, we're going to take a quick break here on the Plus Pitch Podcast. And we're back. Tyler Phillips in New York against the Mets. Five innings, two earned, six hits, no walks, three strikeouts. And other than a singular curveball whiff, splitters were the only pitch to miss any at-bats for Phillips. Four whiffs on the splitter in this one. And I guess he recognized the whiffability of that splitter because he leaned on them as his primary pitch. And I'd say don't let the success that he had as a reliever trick you into believing his season-long ratios. Those are not to be trusted. It's a 4.70 ERA, 1.40 whip, and a 15% strikeout rate in 13 outings since Phillips joined the rotation. His sinker and sweeper are dope, and I think those are pitches that would make him a great reliever, but the four-seamers, splitters, and curveballs are not consistently commanded well enough to consistently take down left-handed batters. Phillips is not somebody I want to be trusting. Cole Drake in Cleveland, four innings, two earned, five hits, one walk, six strikeouts. He was unable to mask his low 90s two-plane four-seamer as the pitch served up four hits and a two-run first-inning homer that accounted for all the damage against Cole Drake. He was unable to throw his secondaries for more than 51% strikes, and Drake failed to be efficient enough to survive five frames. There's swatch potential here as his changeup is pretty decent and he throws fastballs for strikes, I guess, but he's going to have to display better command of his entire arsenal before we can give Drake the swatch label. Yoshinobu Yamamoto versus the Red Sox, eight innings, three earned, four hits, one walk, three strikeouts. Ace is going to induce single-digit whiffs for the fifth time in his last seven starts. He had just five whiffs here, and Yamamoto's become a pitch-to-contact starter, and while it's limited his strikeouts, and they've really been down all year, I think he's below 24% right now, it hasn't stopped Yamamoto from efficiently pitching deep into the games. With Yamamoto not looking like the clear-cut ace that he has been or was last year, and Ohtani struggling with an injury right now, maybe the Dodgers really did need Tarek Skubal. That is satire. They do not need Tarek Skubal. Logan Gilbert versus the Twins, seven innings, three earned, five hits, one walk, six strikeouts. He found an extra tick of velocity to throw harder than he has all year at 97.2 miles per hour, but Gilbert still served up a pair of dingers to diminish what was otherwise an excellent start. Connor Prelip in Seattle, five and a third innings, three earned, four hits, four walks, 5 strikeouts. Nick focused on Prelip's odd usage of sinkers to right-handed batters last time, but he did have faith in his secondary's returning to form here. While I was pretty skeptical that the blister that affected him, that sent him to the IL prior to his last start, I felt like it affected his ability to find the feel for his secondaries, and that's why he leaned so heavily on fastballs in his last start. But looks like I was wrong. Slider showed up for 5 whiffs and 62% strikes here, while changeup surprised with 3 whiffs on just 4 thrown. And after walking 3 in the first, Prelip settled in with just 1 walk across the next 5 frames. And I think this one would have looked a lot better if not only not for those 4 walks, but also a ridiculous 45% foul ball rate on 4 seamers, which led to 13 foul balls and 0 whiffs on his fastball, which made it difficult for him to put batters away or end at bats quickly. And I'm more confident in Prelip than I've been for weeks. Andrew Abbott versus the Pirates, 5 innings, 3 earned, 3 hits, 5 walks, and just 1 strikeout. 5 times as many walks as strikeouts in this one for Abbott, as his command has left the building. That's 9 walks across his last 2 starts, and he looked worse than ever here, bouncing countless changeups, curveballs, and sweepers. And without the ability to pull off the Blake Snell blueprint effectively, Abbott left our bread unbuttered. And I think it's time to give him a break, especially with the lefty killing Nationals up next. Zach Thornton versus the Marlins, 4 2/3 innings, 3 earned, 6 hits, 3 walks, 2 strikeouts. We did not have much faith in Thornton continuing the success with his low V, low contact reliant 4-seamer and cutter approach. And it came to an end here as he struggled to throw strikes while expanding his arsenal to support his 1-2 punch. Thornton has induced double digit whiffs just once in 6 starts this year. And I'm not really sold that his command is elite enough to pull off the Foster Griffin approach of a cutter-led kitchen sink arsenal. Next, we have Ronel Blanco versus the Rangers, 4 2/3 innings, 3 earned, 5 hits, 2 walks, 4 strikeouts. And I'm somewhat enamored with Blanco's stuff as he showed up with a PSA 10 heater. He doesn't throw super hard, but it's got very good shape with very high IVB. He was pitching in a dome here, but it was north of 19 inches of IVB, and he supported it with near mint secondaries. And I love that Blanco looks to sneak fastballs above the zone for whiffs, and that he's displayed a feel for strikes on all of his off-speed pitches. He has a changeup, curveball, and slider, and those 3 pitches combined for 72% strikes on Saturday. Unfortunately, Blanco's still looking to uncover his post-surgery command, and it may be a while until it all comes together. It's always the last piece of the puzzle when a pitcher returns from Tommy John surgery. It may not come together this year, and I'll likely be looking to draft Blanco in 2027. Walker Buehler against the Giants, 4 1/3 innings, 3 earned, 8 hits, 2 walks, and just 1 strikeout. He left our bread unbuttered with just the 1 strikeout, and I think you can blame it on him trying to throw sinkers a third of the time, looking to turn outs on balls in play. That did not go well for him. And Buehler's got to get his bread up if he wants to be somebody that we can trust in the deepest of leagues. Ryan Feltner, 6 innings, 4 earned, 8 hits, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts against the Royals. And as always, Coors is undefeated. Miles Mikolas in Atlanta, 6 innings, 4 earned, 9 hits, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts. And Mikolas is miles away from being fantasy relevant. Tyler Molly in San Diego, 5 2/3 innings, 5 earned, 5 hits, 2 walks, but 9 strikeouts. And Molly's doing everything he can to make himself an enticing trade chip ahead of Monday's deadline. He bumped his fastball velo to a season high 94.2 miles per hour across 6 shutout frames last time. And while he allowed 5 runs on Saturday, he held his second highest velocity of the year at 93.8 miles per hour, induced a season high 9 strikeouts, and nearly survived 6 frames before a 2-out single, a hook out of the ball game, and an inherited runner scoring made this a careful Icarus. My prediction for Molly's landing spot is the Brewers, and that's because I'm honestly surprised he's never pitched for them before. Next, we have Jacob DeGrom in Houston, 3 1/3 innings, 5 earned, 7 hits, 5 walks, and 3 strikeouts. And Ace is going to live out of the zone too often with sliders, produce a ridiculous 30% foul ball rate on 4-seamers, sinkers, and curveballs, and get singled out via a .500 BABIP. It was a very uncharacteristic start for DeGrom, but it marks his second outing in his last 3 with 5 runs allowed. Maybe the glute injury that was bothering him back in mid-July is bothering him more than he's letting on. This start seems more like poor luck, and with the Orioles and Angels in LA upcoming, I would not be afraid to send DeGrom out there for those two starts. Second to last, we've got Jack Perkins versus the Tigers, 5 1/3 innings, 6 earned, 9 hits, 1 walk, but 9 strikeouts. And Perkins did his best to salvage a start in Sacre Verde by racking up a career-high 9 punchouts, but a trio of long balls made this hard to swallow, and this is why we avoid starting pitchers in Sacramento. I still like the strikeout potential from Perkins in deeper leagues, but I only want to start him when he's on the road. Let's hope that preference is warranted in Boston next. And lastly, Luinder Avila in Colorado, 2 2/3 innings, 6 earned, 4 hits, 3 walks, 2 strikeouts. Pitching in Coors for the first time, Avila could not nail down his command as he was unable to adjust to the different movement of his offerings in the thin Denver air. And this is why we avoid streaming pitchers in Coors at all costs. Avila isn't someone that we trust in regular circumstances anyway. And for my game of the day on Sunday, we got Jacob Mizorowski versus Walbert Urania. It's the Miz, and Urania has been throwing triple digits recently too. But that's going to do it for this episode of the Plus Pitch Podcast. You can follow me on socials at Jake Crumpler. You can find all of my work over at crumplerbaseball.com. We'll talk to you all tomorrow.